Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's go!
Russia rolls into Ukraine, Obama golfs while ISIS kills, plus Ferguson cools, Perry chills, that frosty McDonald marriage, and the Ice Bucket Challenge. Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller here in Santa Monica, Robert Scheer on the left in Berkeley, California, Rich Lowry on the right from New York City, and Chrystia Freeland joining us from Canada today. Welcome all from across the country, across the political spectrum, to what I was, I guess, meekly trying to frame as the hot and cold edition of Left, Right, and Center somehow. Serious business as we went to air on Friday. Chrystia Freeland, Ukraine, the Russian convoy, humanitarian convoy, in quotes, kind of crossing the border and, according to NATO authorities, firing artillery from Ukrainian soil. What should we, you know, obviously we have imperfect information at this hour, but how should we think about this?
I think we need to think about this as an incredibly serious and incredibly dangerous moment. I think we need to start by calling things by their proper names. This is not a humanitarian convoy. This is a direct Russian invasion of sovereign Ukraine. We had that in Crimea, but I think there was a hope that that was going to be it. And now we have Russian vehicles coming in directly, openly into Ukraine. And the real concern now is this going to be the pretext for a much bigger movement of Russian forces into Ukraine? What's happened, actually, is that the Ukrainians have been winning. The Ukrainians have been having a lot of success over the summer in pushing out the Russian-led, Russian-armed insurgents. You even had some of the leaders of those insurgents fleeing Ukraine. And what seems to have happened is that Putin doesn't want to allow Ukraine to reclaim control over its own territory. I think it's essential that all of us in the West really stand up to this and really, really back Ukraine. This could be an incredibly dangerous flashpoint. And, you know, it looks as if at a minimum what Russia is pushing for is to create some sort of a frozen conflict in the way that you have in Transnistria, between Moldova and Ukraine. And that region is a source of incredible poverty, of incredible organized crime that's sort of festering. We don't want that in eastern Ukraine.
Rich Lowry, so what does that mean we should do?
Well, first of all, I can't improve on anything that's just been said. I believe we have to back the Ukrainian government to the hilt. It is the democratically elected, legitimate government of Ukraine, whose only offense is wanting to control its own sovereign territory. So we should be backing it diplomatically, economically, and militarily with arms. And you know, there's been an ongoing invasion of Ukrainian territory, starting with Crimea, which was frankly annexed. But the so-called uprising was basically in the east is basically a Russian invasion because it was shot through with Russian military personnel. And now it's just becoming ever more forthright with this convoy and perhaps with Russian troops to follow.
So, Robert Scheer, what do you make of it?
Well, first of all, I don't see this as a left-right dispute. I think there are quite a few people on the right, on the Republican side, who are very cautious about this, and there are Democrats who are very hawkish and have from the very beginning in the Obama administration been cheering this kind of tension. And, you know, I know the three of you, because we've discussed this before, all think it's black and white. But the fact is there was a government in the Ukraine.
I reject that, but go ahead.
I reject it, too.
Right. Let's note that we all reject that characterization, but go ahead.
I see. Well, in your more subtle position, Chrystia just said there's the Ukrainians and the Russians. The uncomfortable fact of the situation is there are people who are Ukrainian who disagree with Krista. She is quite familiar with the situation, has been there, is a Ukrainian, I gather, who feels the government's position is right. There was a government in the Ukraine that had quite the opposite position. There were demonstrations against it, and that government was forced to flee. And so you have a situation there where you have a significant part of the population that is really quite unwelcoming and frightened by the government in Kiev. That's just a reality, whether you like it or not. And the idea that somehow the Russians have no interest in this, and I would point out these trucks, 35 of them had been inspected. They were carrying supplies. They were not carrying equipment. The Ukrainian government then decided, no, they weren't going to let them in. If they were interested in patching things up with their neighbor, they would have let those trucks in. And so when we talk about having a more militant position, I would like to know, what does that mean? So giving them arms, but does it mean sending troops? Does it mean getting involved on that border? And do we really want to demonize Putin? After all, Russia is no longer this communist country. It is a country that has embraced capitalism. It is very actively involved in trade. And why in the world do we want to have the darkest view of this situation? I would point out they happen to have one of the world's more formidable army, and they have an enormous nuclear asset that, we're trying to get rid of and we're trying to negotiate. And finally, if we don't have Russia as an ally in the Mideast and some other areas, we're in a much weaker position. So I don't know why we want to demonize them to this point. Like, there's nothing on their side of the argument. There's no interest they have. And yes, it is black and white. I'm sorry if you object. But it seems to me I have not heard any of you say one word about what might the Russians be doing here that is not just to grab land, that might they have not a single concern about their border or their interests. You have not, in all the time on the show, you have not said a single word that would contradict this narrative that's coming from Kiev and coming from the U.S. State Department.
Including the shooting down of an involvement in shooting down of a civilian airliner. I don't want to spend the whole show on this because we can't, obviously. Chris, just a brief response to that, because we'll be following this every week, I'm sure.
Thank you, Matt. I have to start by saying it's a little bit entertaining for me to hear Robert defending Putin on the grounds of having introduced capitalism into Russia. More seriously, though, look, this is not about demonizing Putin. We're not the ones doing that. Putin is doing this through his own actions. And Putin's authoritarianism began at home. And its chief victims are Russians and are Russian liberals, precisely the sort of people that we should be standing with. Vis-a-vis Ukraine, Ukraine has done absolutely nothing to threaten Russia. The Ukrainian people chose to stand up to their own authoritarian regime, a regime which fled the country, a president who fled the country and lost all legitimacy. The new Ukrainian president was elected in an unprecedentedly open democratic election. He won on the first ballot with support from across the country, despite the fact there were 17 candidates. This is an absolutely democratic regime. And the only offense of Ukraine against Russia is refusing to adopt Putin's kleptocratic system at home in Ukraine and refusing to allow Russia to continue to bite away chunks of Ukrainian territory. So, sometimes in affairs of state, things are pretty clear. And in this one, Russia is the aggressor, and Ukrainians are standing up for the inviolability of international borders, which is something we should be standing up for, and they're standing up for democracy.
Rich, I want to go to ISIS and the awful beheading of James Foley this week. Incredible contrast to, Obama taking enormous flack for the juxtaposition of announcing how angry and grief-stricken and repulsed and how determined America was to, bring these evildoers to justice, paraphrasing, and then, being on the golfing, being out on the teeing off at Martha's Vineyard days later, covering all the tabloids and the New York Press, photos of that. Part of a kind of a broader critique that is linked to what is happening now in Ukraine of the kind of America speaking with kind of too softly, or speaking strongly, but not carrying the big stick in areas where there are bad things going on, and it's going to take more than some pinprick American airstrikes, some would say, to beat back ISIS and the awfulness of what's happening there. How do you see it at this
moment? Well, of course, it was an act of unbelievable savagery, this beheading. It didn't really provide any new information about ISIS. I mean, we knew that they have a taste for torture and murder, and really a medieval view of the world, and that may even be an insult to a medieval way of the world to characterize it as that. I mean, it's frankly evil. And the administration, it's beginning to really grapple intellectually and rhetorically with the reality on the ground. We had these hair-raising warnings from Secretary Hagel and General Dempsey about the threat that ISIS represents. And the more important question than whether the president is golfing or not, and I do think he at least could have taken the afternoon off from the golf course after making this statement the other day, is what they're going to do. And the limited airstrikes in coordination with the Kurdish forces have been quite successful over the last week or so. They've pushed back ISIS from the threat it was potentially representing to Erbil, relieved the humanitarian situation on the mountain there, and took back the Mosul Dam. So all that's to the good. And at the very least, according to the administration, these airstrikes will last for months. The question, though, is whether the administration will commit itself to a comprehensive plan to defeat ISIS, put someone in charge of it with responsibility for it, and follow through. And that very much remains to be seen.
And Bob, to date, it seems clear that Obama's been trying to use this rationale that it's about preventing the genocide on that mountain, and then protecting, you know, Americans who are nearby, and the potential for the dam to flood, and, you know, the embassy 200 miles away could be overrun, but not doing as Rich and other critics of Obama have said, just adopting as an explicit goal that it's in the national interest of the U.S. to defeat what ISIS is doing and apply whatever force and strategy is needed to do that. How do you see that?
Well, it was supposed to be in the national interest of the U.S. to defeat Saddam Hussein, who actually ran a country in which the ISIS-type people had no leverage whatsoever, in which Shiites and Sunnis, whatever the difficulties, at least weren't killing each other. 50 Sunnis at prayer were killed, as we go to air on Friday, and by Shiite militiamen. So you have religious fratricide on a grand scale in that region now. You had a fairly stable government in Syria, which we, again, said was the center of evil, and we backed people opposing it. Some of the people opposing it are moderates, are deserving of sympathy. On the other hand, ISIS came out of that struggle. And as General Dempsey, the head of the Joint Chiefs, pointed out, you can't defeat ISIS without getting much more deeply involved in the war in Syria, which is their base. There are some uncomfortable facts here. How was a force of 3,000, that's what our government says ISIS had when they first invaded, able to sweep through this large area of Iraq when we have been training hundreds of thousands of troops, giving them the best equipment, the best support, and they could not withstand 3,000 troops. ISIS is now supposed to have between 10 and 15,000 troops because they've been successful and they get volunteers and so forth. Obviously, this goes back to a policy of the U.S. intervening, treating anyone who had been in the Ba'ath Party, any of the Sunni political people, most of whom were quite secular, as the enemy, demonizing them, not understanding the complexity of that society. And as a result, we created the breeding ground for a force that is much more significant than al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda considers it too militant, a force that hardly had any leverage before. So in the name of defeating al-Qaeda, we invaded a country that had nothing to do with al-Qaeda, and now we've created an even worse force in a strategically far more important, sensitive area of the world.
Christia, so what do we do?
Well, I think we have to start by both embracing complexity, as Bob has called on us to do, and that is really important. And I do think, you know, Richard Haass has talked about this being the beginning of a 30 years war in the Middle East. That's a terrifying thought, but that may be what is happening. And it is really complicated, and it's not going to be fixed easily. But I think even as we accept that need for complexity and a complex understanding of things, we have to recognize evil when we see it and call it that. And I think Rich was really right to say ISIS is evil, and it's important to confront that. I think there's a real grappling that everyone in the West is doing right now. I think we did believe in that peace dividend after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and maybe even more so after the exhaustion of and failures of the U.S. in Iraq and Afghanistan. But we're not going to be able to withdraw from, the West is not going to be able to withdraw from the world. The world is full of some very, very bad actors, and we're going to have to spend a lot of time and a lot of money on foreign policy, including the military side of that. We're not going to be able to just focus on nation building at home. And that's hard because we all have a lot of problems at home. We have a hollowed out middle class. Mm-hmm. I think we have secular stagnation in the Western economies. But these problems are not going to go away.
Let us know what you think about this latest savagery from ISIS and what the response of the U.S. and the West should be at kcrw.com/LRC. Up ahead, Ferguson cools, Perry chills in that ice bucket challenge. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand from KCRW's smartphone apps, now for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. And share your thoughts on today's show at kcrw.com/LRC.
Head over to the KCRW store to shop for vacations, wine classes, frequent flyer miles, dinners, and more, all in support of KCRW. They won't last long. Check it out now at kcrw.com/store.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller, Robert Scheer of Truth Dig, Rich Lowry of Politico and National Review, Krista Freeland of the Canadian government, for God's sake. Lots to cover, busy news week, and imperfect amounts of time. But Ferguson, Rich Lowry, why don't we start there? The National Guard kind of being withdrawn. Maybe we're reaching some kind of new cooler equilibrium. Very interesting piece people should look at, by the way, in Politico magazine about Al Sharpton's role and his connection to the White House and kind of helping the White House as a kind of intermediary in all of this, which is controversial. What do you make of where we are in Ferguson now, Rich?
Well, hopefully it's simmering down, and there's just never an excuse, no matter how angry or how grieving you are, to firebomb a local business or to steal things from local businesses. And there was a small element in these crowds that was doing that, which put the police in a very awkward position, because when people are acting lawlessly, you need to act to stop it. And it becomes even more difficult if people are throwing rocks or even shooting at you. So I think the anti-police narrative in Ferguson has been way overdone. And it seems as though the community working in conjunction with the police kind of groped its way over the course of a week or a week and a half or so to a process that worked, with the police doing everything they can to diminish the crowds and keep them moving at night, and community leaders, when there are any flashpoints, working in conjunction with the police to try to smooth them over. So hopefully we've seen an end to the violence and to the looting. And the other element here is justice demands a full and fair investigation and should go wherever the facts go in this controversial shooting. And the crowds and folks on the left need to prepare themselves for the possibility that this not only was not an execution, but was not a crime. And that a fully just system is open to that possibility. And I'm afraid too many people are just have been braying for a rush to judgment and will insist on a politicized indictment no matter what the actual facts are.
Bob, it was interesting. The New York Times had a poll out in recent days just showing that the racial divide and how the perceptions of whether the protesters had gone too far, the police had gone too far, with blacks and white Americans viewing this very differently. What do you make of where we are now?
Well, it's a reflection of the deeply racist history of this country, which most of us want to deny. And then we thought with the election of a very reasonable Harvard educated Hawaiian black man, that somehow we had shown that we're not with prejudice. But if you look at the prison, and Rand Paul, by the way, I don't see this as a left-right issue. I think Rand Paul has said some of the most sensible stuff on this. You look at the prison population, you look at the alienation, you look at the lack of jobs, you look at the militarization of the police. We now treat these communities as enemy territory. That's not the way policing is supposed to be done. Bill Boyarsky, who was the longtime city editor and reporter for the Los Angeles Times, has a terrific piece on Truth Dig, where he talks about the deep prejudice of the journalists who covered all this stuff all these years in Los Angeles and elsewhere. How often do you even see a story about the number of black males in the prison system and the treatment and the alienation and the coarsening and the unemployment and the failure of the schools? So we have an apartheid society, and then you have an eruption of it. You had three black officers out of over 50 in a department, and deep racism in that department. And that, to my mind, is the big issue here. Are we going to confront the profound economic split racially in this country, the alienation, and the prison population?
Christian, how does it look from across the border, one way or the other?
Well, it looks very frightening. I'm going to echo a lot of what Bob has said. I think that this is a reminder to all of us that the militarization of the police can be a very dangerous thing. Post 9/11, I think a lot of that happened, and I think we now need to go through very carefully and try to demilitarize the police. I think it's really important for police to resemble their own communities. I think that's another really, really important lesson. And Bob's final point, I really agree with, that we do have, this is true in the United States, it's true in Canada in particular with our Aboriginal people, we have marginalized communities. And it's not acceptable to allow those communities to continue to be marginalized. And I think the rising income inequality that we're seeing, that hollowing out of the middle class in a lot of places, is exacerbating that marginalization. We have to be aware of it, and we really, really need to work on it and not just wait for the confrontation to happen.
Let us know where you think Ferguson is at this hour, kciw.com/LRC. Rich Lowry, our last segment, which I'm bucketing, I'm sure imperfectly, as the kind of icicle segment of the show. Not time for everybody to weigh in on everything, but Rick Perry chilling out after his bad segue, right? After his indictment. Let me go to you as our conservative authority. The conservatives seem so happy this week to be able to cite the New York Times and other liberal sources saying this is obviously a trumped-up charge. What do you make of the Perry thing? It looks like he's going to come out of this. He's going to use this in a way that enhances him.
Yeah, it's helped him. The indictment is a complete joke. It's barely two pages long. It's has about as much intellectual and legal substance as a fifth grader's book report. And there's just no way a governor can commit a crime through an entirely lawful act that is meant to create pressure for another public official to engage in an entirely lawful act. Where does the crime come in? So he will win this case and will benefit from the higher profile it has given him and the sympathy it's created for him on the right.
It's also kind of amazing. I'd never heard of the attorney general in question, the state AG, but to be at like triple the alcohol level with an open bottle of vodka is that's quite a night. Christian, the McDonald trial, which is getting a lot of attention in the U.S., just a window into kind of the kind of sad thing that can happen to a political marriage or marriage involving, you know, a public official over time. Any thoughts from your end on how we're seeing that, the kind of this open defense based so much on the kind of fraying of a marriage over a long period of time, and why that means they couldn't have been in cahoots to shake down anybody for something inappropriate?
Are you asking me, Matt, because I'm a politician and you want me to admit on your show that my marriage is bad because
of
it?
No, of course not. I
was reading a really smart piece by Tim Noah today. I think it was on MSNBC.com about precisely this. And his argument was all of us who are married go through good periods and bad periods and difficult periods. And I do think that's true. I think that particularly in marriages where both partners work, where you have children. That's also really hard. That happens to be my case. And yeah, politics does make it particularly difficult. Politics imposes a particular set of difficulties, which is your voters believe, and they're not wrong in this, that you belong to them. And your family maybe thinks you belong to them, too. So that can certainly create tensions.
Any marital observations, Robert Shearer? Would you like to move to the ice bucket challenge? We've just got a minute left before we ran. Go in whatever icy, frosty direction you want to go.
Yeah, let me take the Rick Perry thing. First of all, I think you're a bit unfair to the attorney the general there, or the district attorney general. She was in a parking lot. She was not driving, and she had a drink. Okay. The fact
triple
is she's
the
gotten,
legal level,
she's,
I think.
She, yeah, but she wasn't driving. Just be fair. But she has also been incredible. First of all, this is a grand jury indictment brought against her. She has been incredibly effective in exposing the crony capitalism of Perry, the use of state power to advance the interests of your friends, the rewards that come politically. And I think Perry, as a presidential candidate, is quite vulnerable on these issues. And while he may beat this charge, and I'm all for innocent until proven guilty, I honestly believe that and hope he is innocent. I don't like to see people go to jail. But I think as a presidential candidate, these charges being aired about the crony capitalism and the payoffs and where the money goes and so forth in Texas is not going to bode well for him.
We have reached that time once again for our famed end of show, Left, Right, and Center Rant, featuring pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum, about 20-ish seconds each. Rich Lowry, your soapbox.
Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, came out for aborting children with Down syndrome for their own good. I don't have words for the contempt I have for the sentiment, so I'd just like to say thank you. Thank you to the families, the friends, the neighbors, the teachers, the volunteers who embrace people with Down syndrome, who love them, and who treat them with the dignity they deserve as equal members of the human family.
Robert Shearer.
Yes, I have great respect for Krista, but I want to take issue with her on one point about the fighting evil and so forth. We've been fighting evil. That's what Saddam Hussein was, and we've made it an even more dangerous world. I believe in caution, in the use of troops, in the use of violence, and I think we have a military-industrial complex of people who profit from war and look for occasions to wage war.
Krista Freeland.
This weekend is the 75th anniversary of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, with which Germany and Russia parceled up and divided Poland. And at that time, a lot of Western Europeans, a lot of North Americans thought it was something happening far away that didn't really affect them. Of course, they were tragically wrong. We have to remember today. At another really crucial moment in what Tim Snyder has called the bloodlands, that when international borders are violated, that poses a risk to all of us.
Two quick things. We didn't get to do full justice to the ice bucket challenge. I just want to raise a toast to it. I think it's so interesting and creative that something like this, we're in this world where things like this can go viral for a good cause and create a lot of entertainment and fun in the process. Also, I'd urge people, kudos to Michael Spector, the New Yorker. Great piece on genetically modified food organisms this week in the New Yorker, really balanced and raises questions about whether there's too much hype on the negative side and whether the science, which seems to, on balance in his piece, say that these GMOs are not as bad as many critics make them out. Very hot area and very rationally done. So that's all the rationally we have time for today on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, as always, to Robert Shearer, Krista Freeland, and Rich Lowry. Laura Dine Million produced today's program. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. I'm Matt Miller. Thanks for listening. Tune in again for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.